From the Ground Up is all about us learning with you, with all these experts that we are bringing in on, from simple strategies to the most advanced property strategies. These people are all successful in what they do and have so much information to share to you, and we cannot wait for you to listen.
To kind of go into, I would say, probably like October time, so we can bang some up because we're going to be away for a little bit. And then, yeah, crack on. But we'll get started.
When are you on Alex's podcast, by the way? Because I'll have a little listen. Do you know when that's coming out for you?
It's already out. Yeah, it came out 2 days ago, I think. Or 3 days ago, 2 days ago. One of the days. I can't keep up. But yeah, it was really fun. Yeah, 100%. I love it. Yeah. I listened to your one. I was like, that's a coincidence. I literally reached out to you. And then it was like this little brain that you just came on this reel with Alex. And I was just like, no. And it was weird because then we obviously met you and it was just like this circle. I was like, it always happens. It's meant to be.
It's like the probability is really small though, isn't it? It's just like you just meet all these people and you're like, oh, you know so-and-so. Oh, you did that with this person. It's like, God, yeah. It's a small world.
Exactly. Do you have a hard stop anywhere? Just so I know that, so I don't
I'm good to about corpus. I've got a call, but I did say I might be a bit late because I did kind of anticipate that we might run over. So I'm good to about corpus one. So that should give you enough time, I'm guessing.
Yeah, we'll try to keep it to like 45 minutes or something and then we're good to go so we can run over. Cool. All right, we'll get cracking. 3, 2, 1. So, Wendy, it's great to have you on. I'm really looking forward to this one. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm excited to be here and thank you very much for having me on your podcast.
Absolutely welcome. I mean, like we only met a couple of weeks ago. I went to one of your networking events and just the way you talked, it's just super inspiring. And I knew that one, I could learn a lot from getting you on, and two, I know so many people can learn so much from yourself doing some crazy things that I just can't even think of doing, but on conversion to the lot. So I think it'd be awesome just to hear a little bit about yourself and a background of how you got into property and kind of, I know you had a completely different journey up until property. So it'd be awesome for everyone to hear that.
Yeah, it was very different, to be honest with you. And it's a really good question and something I get asked a lot was like, you know, how did it all start? How did I get into all this stuff? That kind of thing. And, you know, here's the thing. So, as you know, because you heard me talk, didn't you? I was into figure skating when I was younger, and yeah, I competed up to British Championship level, and then I used to do like shows and pantomimes and all that good cool fun stuff back in the day, and then I used to coach as well, and I loved it. But I think probably one of the things that, you know, we might have spoken about is it's not like being a professional footballer where you earn loads of money. It's not like that. So it was just pure love. And, you know, it was a really good thing. I think it kind of, you know, we spoke about this earlier as well. It's like mindset wise, it's been amazing because I've literally had to fall over on the ice, get back up and carry on. And that's been an amazing lesson for anything in business and in property. So it served me really well. But because it didn't make me any money, I always had to keep up my education. And then I went to university and I lived in a student house share, so otherwise known as HMO, or for those who don't know, house multiple occupation. So that's what I lived in. And then I was a bit late with my rent 1 month and probably drunk too much alcohol and spent all my money on all of that stuff.
As you do, soon.
It's what happens, isn't it? It's just like it's a bit of a party at university, and that was me. And I went to see my agent, my landlord, and basically he lived in this really nice house, and I quizzed him a bit about what he did, and then he said to me, oh, I've got 25 student lets around the university campus. And he was really good, actually, because I literally just sat down with him and quizzed him.
That's so cool.
About his business. And so I spent a few hours there and he shared quite a lot. And then when I went back to my room and I got a spreadsheet out and I was kind of like looking through and going, well, he makes all this money from these, you know, student lets, from me included. And then I was thinking, I can make so much more in a year doing this than I could do going into a corporate job. And that was kind of like my first thoughts on property. And I was kind of thinking, oh, that's what I want to do. That's what I want to get into. But it was always, you know, you hear people, don't you, quite often go, at some point, this is what I want to do later on one day. Yeah. That was probably me back then. If you'd have been with me back then, that's what I was like. I was kind of literally like, one day, this is what I will do. And we've all been there, haven't we? You could probably relate to that as well.
100%. Everyone, I think, is like that. Like, it's putting it off to the future, because to take that action is terrifying. And you don't believe you can do it.
No, you don't. It's kind of like a big thing, isn't it? Especially, I think, because you're very young and successful as well. And I think that's the thing. It's hard when you're younger, because I think you've got loads of energy and loads of excitement. But at the same time, okay, maybe later on in life you've got more commitments. So therefore you've got more to lose. Therefore then that risk feels high. When you're younger, you're just like, oh, less experience in life. So things seem a lot bigger. But then probably you might take more risk because you've got less to lose. It's always kind of like, I think you can talk yourself out or talk yourself in, can't you?
100%.
It probably took me, I think it took me about 10 years to talk myself into it. That's,
wow.
You know,
I didn't know that. Isn't it crazy how, like, our brain is that powerful that we know we want to do something and we're not happy doing something else, but it's just the thought of doing it and that actual action is just like, it's so hard. And I think, that's why having a people around you that can support you or are doing it currently, it just pushes you so much quicker. I think, you know, when you talked about being younger, you can take a lot of risk. I think why a lot of younger people don't do it, and more so probably now because of social media, it's because they have their parents or they have a lot of other wrong friends around saying you're an idiot or no, you need to do this. And you're a lot more influenced at that age, to say the least. When you're 30, 40, you're like, oh, just do it, whatever. So that's super interesting. But yeah, I think you are able to do more risk. But I think society is now making us feel like we can't at the same time.
100%. And I think that's the thing. You kind of go, well, these are older people that have lived life more than me. Yeah. So you want to kind of listen. But that's the thing, as you quite rightly say, you've got to be careful who you listen to. But you don't necessarily know that when you're younger, do you? You see, you know, your elders, you kind of look up to them and you think, oh, you know, they've got all the answers in life. But then what you realize later on is like, I need to make sure I'm taking information from the right people who are where I want to be. And you know, that's a key thing for me about, you know, you mentioned networking meeting. That's where, you know, we met, didn't we, last month?
Yeah.
And the reason that's so special for me was that was my first, step into property, because it took me a long time to get there. And it was literally like, I thought, you know, obviously didn't get that far with, you know, the landlord that I spoke to, but what I thought is I needed to save up a load of money so that I could invest in property. And that's what I did for 10 years. I found literally, I had a pot of money, but that's why I went to a networking event. And what I should have done is done that the other way around. I should have done the networking event first.
Yeah.
Then I realized I didn't need all of my own money and I could work more creatively and there were other ways to get started, and I could have got started earlier, and you know, I am where I am and it's all worked out well, but I could have probably started this 10 years earlier. You know, that's the reality, but you don't know what you don't know, do you? That's the thing.
No, it's so, and do you know what's really cool? Like, you know, now you're mentoring and everything, like you're able to save someone 10 years that you never got to do. And
absolutely,
think about that. Yeah. Like, if you compounded like all the time that you weren't doing what you now know for that 10 years, how much that would cost you. And then I always, do you know what really interests me is, because you hear people say, oh, it's too much money, or this course is too much, or whatever. And then you realize, like, say that 10 years, how much that would actually make you is crazy. Because you're doing some amazing stuff now. Like, you obviously weren't doing what you're doing right now. We'll obviously get into, like, you know, the barn conversions and all these really cool, exciting things that I didn't know possible. But, I mean, did you start off just doing your vanilla buy-to-lets? Is that kind of where you got into property? With that first property you were just talking about? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, just started off kind of small, really. Buy-to-sell, so otherwise known as flips, buy-to-lets.
Mm.
And then I had this realization that if I wanted to make a level of income, so either become financially independent or replace my income, that kind of thing, I then realized I'd need a heck of a lot of buy-to-lets to get there. So I think I worked it out at the time as 97, which,
wow,
as you can appreciate right at the start of your journey, 97 feels huge, doesn't it? Like 97, yeah. Oh my goodness. When I realized that I'd need 22 HMOs to reach that same kind of level, okay? And then that's when it kind of clicked that actually where I need to be placing my attention was to do HMOs, which is where I started, right? Back in a student HMO. So it's kind of like, yeah, realizing that, you know, the buy-to-lets were quite good to start with because I could cut my teeth on something a little bit smaller. And, you know, I realized, you know, I could make 20 or 30K, which to me was quite a lot back in the day in terms of how much I was earning at work. You know, it was like, well, actually, I could do that doing a couple of projects a year, you know. So then I realized, yeah, cash flow wise needed to be a little bit more. So that's why I moved into then HMOs, aligning with my past. And yeah, ended up doing HMOs in Bristol, of all places. Yeah, and Bristol was basically, some people say, why did you end up coming down to Bristol? Because I was based in Newbury. I used to do the corporate life at Vodafone. So, you know, HQ in Newbury, that's where it's at. So that's why I used to go to the Basingstoke Property Investor Networking meetings, because it's kind of around that area. So I moved to Bristol basically because I kind of analysed different cities across where I was at. So I took Bristol, I think I took Reading, got where else I included, but I took a few cities in around the area. But then what I realised was how amazing Bristol was as a city in terms of, you know, it was contributing positive to the economy at the time. There's so many little areas, so much diversity. And so then I was like, well, actually, there's so much opportunity. And that's what drove me down there. And
that's cool. Yeah. So when you were looking, because there's so many people that don't want to buy in their own area, when we want to go buy, we're not just looking at Wales, because, I mean, we have this conversation about all the kind of like handcuffs that you have and no development, but there's still obviously good deals in Wales. But we obviously, I've spent so much time in Bristol. So like, if you were going to talk to me about, okay, you don't want to buy in your local area that you probably know, and you don't know maybe Bristol that well, what would you be going in to the area like looking at to see, okay, this is a good area for a HMO, for example? Because I know a lot of people like that.
Yeah, that's another great question, because how many times do we get asked about where's right to invest?
Yeah, every day, probably.
Like all the time. I get asked it a heck of a lot, especially if people are in an area that, you know, for example, doesn't have a good, what you might call gross development value or end value, and they can get a better one in another city, but they don't know it. And this is the thing, I think it is so important to know where you're investing, like really, really important, because otherwise you don't know the hot spots. You don't know who your end tenant's going to be. And it's all very well creating a really nice property, but then if you've got nobody at the other end who's going to rent it or buy it, then how do you realise the value? You can't, because there's no one there to buy it or rent it. So I think for me at the time, what I did and what I share with other people is that if I am contemplating going to a different city, is to get to know it. So what I do is go to the city, go and sit in the coffee shops, go and walk the streets, find out where all the supermarkets are, because they give me a good indication of the type of person that's there. So, you know, whether it's a Waitrose or a Tesco, you know, you often find Waitrose in more affluent areas. Okay. That's kind of, they know their market, they know where to go. Sometimes it might be retirement, like Waitrose and retirement areas are usually quite popular. So you can usually match a supermarket to a place. Likewise, you can match businesses to a place. Like in Bristol, for example, we have a trendy coffee shop called Grounded.
I don't know if you've been.
And I used to often, so my my tenant market, I suppose, was young professionals. And I knew that they quite like to hang out the grounded, and I knew the grounded would target them. So I used to take account of where the grounded were popping up, because then I'd get a bit of a vibe that if they're going to that area, then perhaps that's where I should be heading, because they could see a market for it. So if it's a young professionals, I'll be going, right, okay, this is where my market's going to be. I'll maybe in the future. So something I need to track. Also like hospitals and business parks and things like that. So I've got one HMO that is right by Southmead Hospital that works great, because a lot of the doctors and nurses will reuse it. And so I track what's going on in those areas, but you know, you don't know the good parts and the bad parts unless you're in it. And you drive the streets, you walk the streets, and you sit in the coffee shops and the cafes. So I think that's the thing. When people say that to me, I'm just like, go to the city and spend some time there. Chat to the people in the area. Get to know it. And so that you get a really good idea of who's going to be, say, living in your houses at the end of it. So that's how I did it. If you're more remote, because there are people, you know, I don't know, that live in Dubai and invest in the UK, you know, you see it happen, and some of them do it successfully. It, you know, it wouldn't be for me unless I had a team. And that's the key thing. If you've got good people on the ground that know the area, that can manage your properties, then I think it's something you can do, as long as you've got this tried, tested, you know, team that can work for you on the ground in that area. Then I think you can make it work. But I think otherwise, if you're trying to do it yourself, I think you realistically have got to be within an hour. As I say, everybody's different. But in my experience, I find anything more than an hour away can be hard work.
I love that answer. That's super interesting. I've never had anyone detail like analyzing an area like by looking at a Waitrose. But that makes sense. Because... it's a really similar analogy that I would say to someone that comes to me saying, like, I want to see if this SA works. And I say, and it's in like a area that they're not sure of. The first thing I would look at is obviously what listings are there and what's the nightly rates they're achieving. But if it's a, depending on the property type, look at how many hotels are there. So if there's a Premier Inn there or, you know, whatever, they've done so much research to spend the millions of dollars to put that there. They're not going to do that on a whim. They're going to do that because they know, like a Waitrose, that they're going to get results, especially when Waitrose, you know, is so expensive for a lot of people, especially now because it's only gone up. So that's really, really interesting. So with your journey, so you did your HMOs, and then you obviously, I mean, you've done a few things. Where did your book come into this? Like, because you obviously came quite successful as a HMO landlord. What point did you go like, oh, I'm just going to be an author?
Yeah, I know, it was a bit like, where did that come from? It's interesting actually, because I think right at the start, and I don't know if you've done this, have you got a vision board? Do you have a vision
board? I do.
Yeah. So this is where it started from. And it's something that I share quite a lot in the book, because I'm on vision board number 3, and my vision board is actually up here in front of me right now, my new one. But when I first started, one thing I wanted to do was build my dream house, which is kind of literally sitting behind me. You might see
it. Such a nice house, yeah.
Bless you. Yeah, and so it's just like, well, I want to do that, and writing me a book. Just always wanted to write a book. And do you know what I think it was for? It's almost from that I'm a very mathematical type person. So my degree at university was computer science, of all things. But I find that stuff more logical and easier to do. But writing actually isn't my thing. So I'm not that great at spelling. If you would see me write things on boards, I'm usually checking with everybody else if I've spelt it correctly, and they're usually spelling it for me. But I'm just kind of put my hands up and go, do you know what? That's not my forte. Can I say, you know, did I write a good dissertation at university? Well, yes, because I kind of knew what I wanted to put in there. The knowledge is there. But, you know, I did heavily rely on, you know, Word to make sure that I'd got all my grammar and my spelling correct. And so there was always kind of that, I think, what can I say? I'd probably say that doubt in my mind in a way. And so for me, it felt almost a bit like a challenge that I'd like to share some of the knowledge that I've got from being in sport, because I think it's been really valuable for taking action in my property journey. And that's the thing, isn't it? That you probably get as well, is there's one thing having all the knowledge. There's another thing putting that knowledge into action, because that's where it starts to hurt in your head, doesn't it? It does. It's just like, oh my God, I've actually got to do this. Yeah. And that's what gets uncomfortable. It gets out of your comfort zone. And I almost wanted to share that because I think a lot of what I learned from being in sport translates so well to business. And when I've studied like people, you know, further than me, you know, right at the top of the game in terms of like Olympic champions, and I've gone through and studied them. Mm. And what I found from that was so many of them at the top of the game in sport actually then went on to be really successful in business, applying a lot of the same things that they did from sport, because it's all that just persistence, resilience, you know, feeling the fear and doing it anyway. You know, all of those things, I think, just, you know, pour over. So I wanted to share that. And then I think actually being, when we went into lockdown, was the almost like the perfect time that I had to say, sit down and be able to get it all out of my head. And I was quite surprised, actually. All I did was just write. Just, you know, some days are better than others. But I just used to write it down, and I didn't really care. Like at the time, it was all perfect. Because I thought I'll just get it all down and then speak to a publisher and get them to make it look better. But what was quite interesting, what came out of that, was then when they looked at it, they were like, what are you worried about? Actually, this is probably the most organized book we've ever had. It's all in chapters. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because you often have your own limiting beliefs. And interestingly, that's what I talk about in the book. You know, I talk about limiting beliefs and holding yourself back. And I was doing the same to myself. But it just shows you we all have it. So that's really what's kind of sat behind it back in the day. And then I finally made it happen. And I was really excited. I became an Amazon bestseller. And I was super happy about that, because all my profits for that go to dog charity. So I've kind of been able to give back through it as well, which has been amazing.
That's awesome. Too awesome, isn't it? Like, I think that's so cool to say that that's one of your biggest weaknesses, and you just dove into it and did it. I know it would be terrifying to publish that, because it's, I imagine it's your brain, how you think, but a lot of this world, you know, people judging you on like posting that, people saying, oh, that's dumb, that's stupid. So it takes a little courage, I think, to post a book, because people are terrible these days. But when you talked about the sport crossover, I'm massive into sport when I was younger. Like, I would literally play sport from Monday to Sunday, honestly, every night, be training. And it was Aussie rules back then, and basketball. And it's competition. Business is a competition, and everything is about trying to win and be better, and also hard work and getting back up when you fall down, and not always being the best, but having to learn and practice and constantly get better and better and better. And I think that's the difference between a lot of, I would say, property people that start out, and you know, you talked about taking action. It's just that they go pay for the course, they go get the knowledge, but then speak to the agent, speak to the landlord, or try to get the deal. They're like, oh, there's always an excuse. And it's just that one little extra step. It's just that it doesn't take a lot. You get it done once, and then the kind of floodgates open, because now you're not worried of dying or whatever comes into your brain in that moment. You know, you're kind of free, which is really, really cool. Did you start mentoring just after that book then? Because did that tie in quite well once that book came out?
I think I was mentoring in property a bit before okay. Then.
Awesome.
But how I kind of started around that time.
How long have you been mentoring now?
Good question. Probably, it's probably about 5 years. Maybe around that kind of time. 4 or 5 years.
How has that been? Yeah, how has that been? Because I feel like that could be the most rewarding thing, especially if you have like your team members, or not team members, but mentees, not doing what you did basically for 10 years. I imagine that's quite like a fulfilling thing.
Yeah, I save the money. I mean, I invested, you know, I'm investing myself as well. So, absolutely. You know, I have mentors too. And I see the value in it because, you know, they save me a lot of money over and over again and give me, you know, exposure to things that otherwise I wouldn't know about. So I do value being surrounded by, you know, like-minded people, like you say. I think the reward comes in when you see people achieve getting their first purchase, for example. These are kind of, you know, they've got there because they've been guided by you, so you've been part of their journey. One thing I find is, you know, I'm there to support, encourage, give knowledge, all of those kind of things, 100%. But the thing is, there's also a lot of credibility that goes to the person who's getting mentored, because they're the ones that actually got to take that action.
Definitely.
And so I'm always just like, when I get the right people, I think that's what's very key for me, is I want to work with the right people who I think are going to take the action, because then it is so worth it for them to work with me, because I know they're going to get results. And, you know, I don't always get it right in terms of, you know, I try and work with, you know, the people who I think are going to do well. And in the most part, they do. But there are people, you know, that no matter what you do, unfortunately, they won't take the action, and maybe it wasn't for them after all. And, you know, that's how life is sometimes. You know, that's how it is. But for all the people I do help, then it's 100% worth it. And, you know, I have some people doing all different kinds of things. You know, I've literally got a couple, you know, who are, you know, buying their first house, to people doing airspace projects. Yeah. So it's a real range, but, you know, it depends what success is for you. And that's the most important thing, getting your own success, not about anybody else's. You know, we're not comparing like for like. It's getting your own success. And when I see that makes it all worthwhile.
100%. No, that's awesome. I love to hear it. And I love airspace, interests me so much. I don't know enough about it. I'm hearing someone speak on it. And correct me if I'm wrong, yeah, but it's basically building on top of London's buildings, because there's nowhere else to build in London. But that's coming massively popular right now. It's flying, from what I can see.
Yeah, I mean, it works quite well in London because you're limited on space. So, but you can do it anywhere in England. You are limited. I know you're in Wales, so I'm sorry about that, but can't do it in Wales. Probably like most things.
hopefully Labour allows you to do it in England forever and doesn't just take it away from you, even though they want to build all these houses and Labour just like stopping you from converting things. Oh, it's just, it makes no sense in Wales. It's silly.
It doesn't, isn't it? And it's interesting that you could just literally hop over the bridge essentially and then you could do this. So
what happens if I build a house in like Hereford, like half in Wales and half in England? Can I convert half the house maybe?
Exactly.
Just stop at the border, like have a double extension. Yeah, I know. It's crazy. I don't know why. And I don't get it. We could talk about this for ages, but like it's just causing rents to go up, which is great for landlords. It's great for our business. It's causing that rent to go up, which is great, you know?
Yeah.
But the issue is that the people underneath are getting smashed with every increase. For some reason, they keep blaming the landlords. Really weird. Don't get it.
I know. And this is the thing, isn't it? Because almost this is driving rents up. And, you know, I almost feel bad for tenants in this situation because they're paying more rent. And they're finding more and more difficult to get on the housing ladder. And, you know, really we need help to, say, develop more properties, which I think the Conservative government's going that direction, weren't they, in terms of helping incentives to try and help us create more homes. But, you know, really people need more homes to live in, more opportunities around that. And, you know, we have a housing shortage. At the end of the day, we have a housing shortage.
Yeah.
And we have various pieces of, say, you know, we spoke about this at the Bristol Property Networking meeting last time, didn't we, about pieces of infill land and empty buildings. So there are opportunities there, you know, for developers to create homes and, you know, much needed homes, really.
Yeah, definitely. And this comes on to my next part, because this, I think this ties in perfectly. And this is something that I think a lot of people are going to be like, whoa, why? How is that even possible? Why would I do this? So before we get in, do you know this stat randomly? Do you know how many barns there are in England that would be good to convert, like, randomly?
No, I don't. The reason I wouldn't know that is because it depends on the type of barn of whether it would fall under permitted development. Yeah.
That's a good point, yeah. But that, my question there is, because Wendy's doing some amazing things in barn conversions, and I think you've got a massive one going on right now. Talk us through this as a strategy, because I think this is something that a lot of people are just missing the ball on. It's just in front of their face, and it's one of those things that it doesn't make sense, and that's why people don't do it, but that's why people make a lot of money doing it, because you've got some amazing things going on and previously done stuff as well.
So with this particular one, this is the thing with the barns, they're not quite so straightforward as doing commercial. If you're doing commercial to residential, it's slightly easier permitted development. So often that can be a good way to start. With the barns, some of them do have what we call Class Q rights, which is permitted development. All right, so it just has to meet criteria. I won't reel it all off because there's a lot. So it has to meet this criteria. And so if you find something that does meet that criteria, then essentially you can do permitted development rights on it. And you know, with our particular situation, we're working with a farmer. So and the idea is that we get the permitted development rights for the building, work together, and then we split the profits. So this is kind of probably a situation where I'm not owning the building, but I am, you know, in control of doing, or we are in control of doing the planning. And so we do that part, which when it's PD, obviously there's a lot, so PD, permitted development, there's a lot less risk associated with it than it would be if, for example, if you're doing full planning. And, you know, you don't have to drive too far, do you, from any of our towns and cities to find some of these buildings in the countryside. So they are around. They're not as many as you know, as commercial buildings or residential buildings, but they are out there. And, you know, many of them can be converted into homes.
Crazy. And I was in the belief that it was much harder to convert a barn than just build up. But you told me differently. And I still don't get how. I get it, because there's some structure there, but it's a barn structure, not a house structure. How does that cross over?
Yeah, so it's not, so it probably isn't as straightforward as having, so if you've got a commercial building, you know, like probably one of the easiest ones to work with is an office space. So, you know, that's something else where we're kind of doing at the moment is an office to flat conversion. So that is easier to work with because you've got a lot more structure. When you're doing with, you know, work with the barn structure, there is an upside to the fact that there is a structure there to work with. So when you're literally just coming out of the ground and doing, you know, like my house behind, and you're digging into the ground, there's so many unknowns there, that is more complicated. So you're kind of probably sitting in the middle between a commercial building and a new build. This probably sits somewhere in between. So it's probably not quite as costly as a new build, but not as cost effective maybe as doing a commercial to residential. That's probably where you're at. But at the same time, you are working with an existing structure, which it is a benefit. Yeah, because you do have something there to work with, if that makes sense.
That makes total sense. Is this something that you're going to pursue a lot more now? Or is this like a little bit of like a as they come, or is that like you're gonna, you know, iron in onto this strategy and find more barns?
Yeah, it's part of my strategy. So one of the things I work on with people is to do planning permission for like infill land and things like that. Self-builds, barns come as part of that. And it can quite work quite well to put the two together. So if you kind of got some land with a barn on it and you've got some land at the side, you can sometimes bring those two things together to work quite well. One being permitted development, so creating kind of like the concept, and then moving on to, you know, there's more risk, obviously, if you're doing planning permission. So we do have to be careful what we take on, because obviously if you're doing something right in the middle of the countryside and it's green belt, yeah, your chances of getting planning on something like that are probably close to zero in most cases, not in all cases, but it's a lot more complicated. So it's being selective, and making sure that you pick things like brownfield, maybe even something that's, you know, a piece of land that's had something on it already, like a bungalow or, you know, derelict bungalow with a lot of land. We see quite a lot of those around. They could work quite well because essentially they might be easier to get planning on rather than being like right in the middle of nowhere.
No, that's super cool. I had a run in with a greenbelt recently. Someone contacted me for a house, and there was like this beautiful double garage, a massive area of land. I didn't know anything about greenbelt. It was a while back. And I was like, oh, cool. This is a really cool opportunity. And I was like, this is my first deal. I was like, I will source this on. I'll pass it on to someone that I know. They came over and they're like, pretty sure it's a greenbelt. I was like, oh yeah, but it's, they want to build homes, you know? Why can't we just build homes there? Like, oh no, it's like preserved area, you can't do it. And it was this massive area, literally you get 3 or 4 houses in there. And it's, the planning just like, no, you can't build there. There's nothing, it's a barren land. And I was just like, I do not understand that. But I guess it's my understanding, it's preserved so people can't just build everywhere. Just kind of control the areas. But I think a lot of people, these kind of little things without like training or understanding, you know, just exhibit A, you just don't know this and you're going into deals and you're just like trying to wind and dine and wheel and you just get caught out with all these little granular things that you never know. And I think, imagine knowing everything on a barn conversion is like paramount. You're going to be in a situation. I'm sure you probably have this, like, if you don't mind sharing, like, have you had a deal that's like a bad deal that you lost a decent amount of money on there, or maybe you've spent 6 months and not made any profit on it? Why was that the case when you did that deal?
Yeah, I've had nothing, you know, like devastating.
That's good.
You know, but I have had things come up that I wouldn't do again. Let's put it that way. That have, you know, cost more money and been a bit of a blow at the time and eaten into my profit. And I think this is a key thing that you raise, is that, you know, being guided by the right people and being surrounded by coaches and mentors makes perfect sense, because they help you not take on these super risky projects that potentially, if you don't know what you're doing at this level, you can lose a lot of money. I think when you're doing a residential, like a flat or something, if you make a mistake there, you're probably going to be all right. You might lose a little bit of money, or, you know, come off net or something, but it's not going to be, you know, hundreds of thousands of pounds that, you know, otherwise could be if you're doing the bigger projects. And so that's where I think it is so important. For me personally, I mean, I think my first commercial to residential conversion, which, you know, it wasn't a huge project, but it was one of the most complicated ones. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because I sometimes say to people, bigger doesn't always mean more complicated. You can have smaller things that give you a much bigger headache. And, you know, that one really was, it just kept giving. It really did. Just thing after thing would come along, and I was just like, I was kind of a little bit relieved when it came to the end. And it was good in the end, but it wasn't as good as what I thought it was going to be. I thought there was more margin in it. And luckily, this is what I kind of say to people all the time, is make sure you do your due diligence. You have several exit strategies, and you have plenty of contingency in there, because then if things like this happen, it's not going to be make or break. It just means you're not going to make as much profit, or worst case scenario, you'll break even, which is kind of where you want to be. And yeah, on that particular project, we probably ended up you know, making a few little mistakes on things that meant, you know, the big chunks of money. With, you know, with the house behind me, one thing that we had to do was, so originally it was going to be drainage, like soakaways, across the site, but we couldn't do that. So what we had to do is connect into the main drain system down the road.
Ouch.
And you can imagine putting in extra drainage. And
yeah,
it was expensive, let's just put it that way, and it wasn't in our cost plan to start with because we didn't know.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah, wow.
But then that's a gotcha that now you always think about. Literally always go, do you know what? I need to make sure that what's the deal with drainage? And I know this was taught me. You know, I thought I had it since, but I didn't look far enough. I think there was another one which we were going to take on a site, and now I always check where the water companies are putting their pipes, because something I didn't realise first off was that there was an absolutely massive water pipe that ran right the way through the site that could really impact how many houses I could get. And so, you know, that was huge because it would affect, you know, the end value and essentially maybe what I could pay for it at the front end, or what kind of, you know, creative deal I could do, because I couldn't, you know, you look at something and you're almost now, there's a checklist of all the possible things that I need to check. And, you know, it's always things that I, you know, pass on. And now the checklist's pretty long because, you know, I've had mentors say to me, check all this. And then when you do projects, you almost then come, you know, you're always learning no matter what project you do. So there'd be something that came up that you hadn't thought of. And then next time you just add it to the list and, you know, just hope that they're problems you can solve. And I think they've always been problems I can solve, but some of them, you know, they've hurt my pocket. There's no doubt about it. And they've only really been manageable because I've done my due diligence. I put contingency in place. And that's what I say to people. You always need it because you never know. It's the unknown unknowns that you just don't know are going to come up.
That's so valuable. I think that's amazing. And I know that in like the smallest kind of fraction of, like, we're doing our house refurb right now and like nothing bad's gone wrong, which is great. But there's so many things that if this was an investment property and we're trying to flip it or needed to get off a bridge, we would have been burning money because it's been like 5 or 6 months, but luckily we're not in a rush. There's like a lead pipe on the stop tap, and we had to dig through the living room out to the drive and contact Welsh Water, and then they took about 6 weeks and we couldn't do anything for like 6 weeks of the plumbing. It was like, oh my god. Imagine that little thing just delaying you a month. It could cost you thousands on the bridge. And we didn't know any better. We just kind of rocked up. We did ourselves. We got a structural survey and we're like, cool, nothing's breaking. Nothing's wrong. It's structured. And then luckily, you know, touch wood, we're still going. Nothing's come up that's like stopped it. But I wouldn't even thought to look at a drainage that could impact like where you're going. But you know what? It's a really funny thing. And I know you mentioned this the other day, was a cost that you didn't expect was your blinds for your house. Because it's quite a custom design, isn't it? Because you've got the double roof. So we played a guessing game of how much those blinds were. And I think that, what were they? It was like, what was it again? Like,
for the whole lot that was. But I think, for those ones, those ones on their own were kind of, I think, between like 5 and 10. And I would do it differently in future, because I think what you can do is you could at the moment the windows are slanted, but you've got nothing in between. So what I would do in future is just break it off here. So I could put a blind from this piece down.
That makes some more sense. And then do you budget for that when you? So what were you saying?
Sorry, no, you carry on.
What I was saying was, did you budget for that in your kind of projection of how much the house would cost? Yeah. So it's so interesting that, because that, like, imagine anything like 10 or 15 grand in like a flip, and actually they could almost ruin the deal. Like, all of a sudden you're only making 5 or 10% profit. Yeah. You have to be so granular, and that's what I've learned from just listening to you, but doing one, you know, semi-detached house, you have to be so granular because there's all these little things that can really ruin it. Where do you, what's your thoughts, moving off development, what's your thoughts on this new renters reform or rights bill? They've changed the name. I can't remember what it's called, but how are you, because you're a landlord, you've got a lot of HMOs, I imagine. What's your kind of thoughts of this right now?
Another great question. And yeah, everyone is going to be different on this, aren't they, in terms of how it affects them, you know? I think, yeah. I mean, I'm guessing it's going to send people a little bit more into the serviced accommodation world.
Perhaps. Yeah, so.
You know, I think it's something I've, you know, considered because I do have some, you know, I've got buy-to-let. Serviced accommodation is actually something I don't do. So, but I do know how to do it. And, you know, it's made me think about that. You know, it really has. And yeah, it does make you a little bit concerned. It probably makes you think more about the types of people that you have in your properties and being, you know, you always need to make sure you're doing your referencing and everything. But, you know, you almost become more particular about that. So maybe in the past you may have taken a little bit more of a risk on somebody, but you're probably going to be uninclined to do that anymore, right? But yeah, I think you'll see probably some landlords sell up. You know, I think that's likely, isn't it, to happen?
Yeah.
You know, but then that does, on one side, there's some, you know, that's a shame, but there is sometimes some opportunity, or there will be some opportunity in
there. Definitely.
For sure. But yeah, I 100% think that, you know, SA will be maybe more of a way to go for people. That would be my thoughts, because that's also where you don't have tenants and you can increase your cash flow.
Yeah. Wow. Why? How would a landlord turn that away?
Exactly. And it gets rounded.
Why do you think?
Go on,
yeah,
sorry,
Zach. Exactly. No, you're fine. Don't apologize. That's all good. What is it that about the kind of bill that's making even you think about going to SA? Like, is it this no fault eviction, Section 21 being removed? Is it the 6-month contracts? Like, what is the big pain point that you find landlords are going to be like, this is a no-go?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because I kind of think I quite like the Section 21 because I thought it was a nice, soft way to evict people as well if, you know, even if they're breaking the terms of their tenancy. It was just a nicer way of doing it. And, you know, I haven't done it that often, actually, but I did have a few difficult situations where I've issued one Section 8, okay, in a very difficult situation.
Is that court? Is Section 8 going to court, or is that a...
No, not necessarily. It just means, so the Section 8 essentially is probably mostly what you're going to be left with now, but it's when, you know, your tenant breaks the terms of the tenancy conditions.
Gotcha.
And then you evict them on that basis.
Yeah.
But yes, it can end up in court for sure. But it's sometimes a nicer, softer way to do it with the Section 21 and can be much easier. So it's kind of a bit easier for us. But I also felt it was nicer to the tenant as well, even if they had broken their tenancy terms and conditions. It just felt a better all-round way of dealing with it. So I preferred that just as a way of working. And yeah, I suppose that's the one that bothers me the most, because say, you know, if you really wanted to get your property back for whatever reason, maybe it's not making financial sense for you anymore, just say in the worst case scenario, it's going to be really hard to get your property back. So that, you know, would be one of my concerns around it, really. It's not going to be easy to do something. So someone's not paying rent. You know, okay, you can issue a Section 8, but then we know what it's like. It's a bit chaotic, isn't it? Being quite frank around that. So by the time you get your property back, say, you know, you've then got to then, you know, pay all your mortgage up until that point where you get your property back, and then you don't know what state it's going to be in. So then you might have to redo it back up again, et cetera, et cetera. I suppose that's what's going to be on people's minds, isn't it? If, you know, if they're, you know, looking to rent out. And so I know that's going to be more difficult for me. So I just kind of go, you know, I always look for what's the most simplest cost-effective way to run my business. Now, I know serviced accommodation, you know, for me in the past, one of the reasons I haven't done it is because it's more hassle than renting my property out.
A lot more. Yeah. Yeah. 100%.
It's more hassle.
That's why we exist. It's a lot of work.
It's even more hassle than HMOs, isn't it?
So much. You know? Yeah, it's crazy. Like SA is a noisy business. Like, you know, we've got 7 team members with 70 properties, and it's like it and we're not out of it. Like, we're still in it. It is a noisy, but we love it. And it's not for the faint-hearted. But that's kind of why we do management, just like there's HMO management companies, because, yeah, you know, HMOs, there's a lot of going on all the time, and a lot of landlords don't want to do it. Even they don't want to even do just normal buy-to-lets, which I find very kind of simple and easy because there's only one person.
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
But a lot of people don't know, like, a management company exists, and that's why they stay away from SA. My concern with a lot of people trying to jump into market is that a lot of people are going to have no idea how to do it. It's like buying a house and not knowing what to buy, and overpaying and overspending. And we find this all the time where we'll get a landlord that will contact us and go, hey, I want to do SA. I've set it up. This is good to go. Can you manage it? I go in, I'm like, yes, but like, you've kind of set it up completely wrong to what I would do it, and it's going to make that yield less, and you may find that you actually best just to do it as a buy-to-let, like, financially, but now you have more control. So we like to get involved early, but and I know you have like an interior design background, which we didn't even get into, so you'd be fine with it, but like, we find that a lot of people just don't, they understand the design aspects, and this is why I sometimes have a problem with stages, is that they stage it from a design, looks beautiful, great, but functionality wise, like, not thinking about what type of clientele you're going to be getting there, how many toilets, who actually is going to book a 2-bed with 1 bathroom, and your corporate's not going to get in there. Just these little intricate things, like, if I was to do development, I would need to know from you. And I find that it's not just this standard thing. So I think a lot of people need to, like, if they want to do it, speak to other people that are doing it and learn how to actually do it. Or pay someone to do it, you know, if you want the hands off, go do it. And that's my concern, is a lot of people are going to do that and then go back to doing what they don't want to do. But
I think you're right. And, you know, I'm surrounded by people who know how to do service accommodation. So a bit like yourself, you know, if, you know, I was going to get advice on development, I'd find someone who's done that, blah, 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 like I have. And the same thing with service accommodation, you know, for me, it's not something I've personally done. So therefore, I am surrounded by people who do it very well. And so therefore, you know, that's where I take my guide from. Exactly. And that it's the same thing. And you've got to know 100% what you're getting yourself into. So it's just like, you know, I'm fully aware that I know it's a lot of work. You know, I know that. But then if it is a better outcome, essentially, and it might be a better outcome going forward, then obviously it's something you consider. And, you know, I'm quite fortunate enough that my portfolio isn't heavily leveraged. So for me, you know, I'm still doing pretty well on the rents at the moment. So it's not hit me as hard as it has maybe if you're more highly leveraged. So there is that. But then, you know, you also have to think about the bigger picture. And I'm kind of thinking, you know, perhaps it might be something I might test. You know, I might just get one of my flats and just test it out on a serviced accommodation and see if it's the right fit. You know, I think with these things, it's going to just make people, isn't it, just rethink things and decide what's right for them. So it's either going to be sell or it's going to be finding, they might stick in it and go, do you know what, we'll take it. And then for other people, maybe have had bad experiences with tenants, they'll either sell or kind of go to a service accommodation route. But that's probably where we see it's heading. So be interesting to see how it all works out. When won't it over the next kind of year and see where it takes us. What's your thoughts, Zach? Are you thinking more people are going to come into your service accommodation market?
100%. Like we're big now. Like that news came, we're like, we're going to go into Bristol. Because I love Bristol. I love it as an area for service accommodation. We get so many inquiries all the time for it. We're like, we don't have any units. So we want to go into Bristol heavily. You just have to turn to Wales. And I think this is what England don't do sometimes. They don't look at Wales and what's happening in Scotland. They're in their own little bubble. both Wales and Scotland went through these regs and changes. So I don't know if a lot of people know this, but come next year, from April 2025, all those tax regulations for service accommodation, they end. But what any council can do is double your council tax for service accommodation. So you're then paying double council tax. And that's happening in Wales. Some places charge three times to keep landlords out. So this is all happening right now in Wales. So in Cardiff alone, it's 200% premium. So if you're paying 150, you're paying £300, which can sometimes can ruin a deal. But there's also the increase when you go into business rates. So currently in England, it's 140 days we can get in there. In Wales, it's 252 days. So that makes it easier in England. But if you then go into April next year, so if you do it now and then you wait, or if you do it now, you go onto business rate quite quick. But if you do it in a year from now, you're going to have like double council tax, and they may increase that as well. So I know a lot of people are going to be moving to it, and it happened in Wales. So Swansea and Cardiff grew quicker than any place in the UK, and they actually grew to have more units, if not similar units, to what Birmingham had, and they have not even near the population, because a lot of people, we had those reg changes, we had the new contracts, now everyone's like occupation contract, all this. You have to give tenants 6 month notice to get back your property, and there is section 21, but there's so many regs, and it was caused so many people to leave. I know a landlord that sold 19 properties, just like bang, gone. It's like, I'm not dealing with this anymore. So I'm a big believer that there's going to be a lot of opportunity here, and there's going to be a lot of people entering it. There's going to be a lot of people who don't know what they're doing, which means there's a good market for it. So I think I don't think it'll be horrendously bad. I think there's going to be some properties, higher market ones, that can work really well. But I know what's going to happen in the next year. Service accommodation is going to blow up again. It's going to be like what, pre-COVID. So it's quite a long answer to your one, but that's like my kind of honest opinion, because that's what's happened in Wales. You just gotta look what's happened around you, unfortunately, even though it's a little tiny Wales.
And it's not an easy one to answer, is it, to be quite honest with you? There's so many different people, different kind of levels that you can look at this on, and so everyone's got a different circumstance. So there's something, when I'm talking, it's just like as I'm talking, there's like things coming into my head, and I'm just like thinking, I'm looking at this from my position, but so many different positions.
Yeah, 100. I couldn't agree more. Before we wrap it up, what I want to know from you is what's the next 2 years for Wendy? What's that look like? Because you've got that vision board. I'm really curious to see where that vision board ends, and like where, you know, you want a beach? Are you building another dream house? Like, you're done with that dream house? Is that a Ferrari? What is it?
I think there will be. I'm looking up now just to kind of see what's on it. So I'd probably say I would build another house, because I never expected this. You see, like, you build a house and then you learn about what makes a good house to live in, which you don't know until you do it. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because I used to complain, you know, with the bigger house builders, that, you know, when you go in and you look at a house and they give you all of these kind of, you can have this flooring or that flooring, but it's quite restricted. But here's the thing. I can see why they do it now, because when you open up absolutely everything, you're like, oh, God, my business isn't, and you go on and you're just like, I don't know what I want anymore. But I think this process has taught me is one big learning from all of this was when I build a house going forward, is to just stick to a box. It's the easiest thing to carve up. I got a bit creative, made my life more difficult. Not going to do that again.
Love that.
Box. I'm like, I know what I'll do in future, and maybe not right now, but I'm like literally probably about, you know, once I've probably finished this completely, like inside and out, I'll be, when's the next thing? But maybe like 5 years time, something like that. I'd definitely do it again and do it better. That's usually how I am. It's like, I do this and it's like, oh, actually I could do a better job. So I'll maybe do it again. So that's probably where I'm at with it. In terms of what's here, I'm just having a quick look on terms of the vision board. So one thing I'm doing actually next week is I had Athens on my vision board. So I'm going there next week on holiday. So it's interesting how these things come off. Some of them aren't crazy. Another one was somewhere here. I'm just looking up. I think I've got, is it Milan? Yeah, Milan Olympics. So the Winter Olympics in Milan. That's something else I wanted to see.
You're not competing, are you, in the Olympics? No. You're making a surprise return, yeah?
I'm just doing what, I think. But yeah, I've kind of got, so I'm doing a commercial conversion at the moment, and that's been on my vision board for a bit. So I just keep it up there because I just want to keep doing it. So I just kind of keep a picture up there of commercial conversion. So I keep doing them, but each time just maybe just do something a little bit different, a bit bigger, a different type of project. And one thing I'd really like to do is a bank. I've never find them so cost effective. So I've always ended up doing better projects that have come up. I think I had the barn up here, which I've now, you know, one of them I've done, but again, I keep that up here as well. So yeah, it's for me to, I suppose, keep on doing the development projects. I kind of have about 4 projects going on at the moment and I enjoy doing them. So for me, what I always do is just do more, just doing slightly different ones, either bigger, slightly more complicated, slight variances each time, just to keep it a little bit different. So that's probably what I'll do.
Love it. Just more of the same, a little bit different, a little bit of sprinkles on it, and smashing it. So I mean, look, you're doing awesome. Your personality is infectious, and I think I'll tag your socials and the stuff where everyone can find you, because you know, when I saw you present, I was like, I need to get on the podcast, because you've shared so much value on this, where you started, and even I know you're massive at mindset. I think that's such an important takeaway, because it doesn't matter how much you know, if you can't take action, it's just, you're going to do nothing with it. And I think too many people think they can do it because they learn, and it's just a struggle. So it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Enjoy Athens. I'm jealous. It's going to be terrible weather probably next week in the UK, so you'll be there enjoying Athens and all its beauty. So have an amazing rest of your day, and I look forward to seeing you again and talking soon.
Brilliant. And thank you so much. Really enjoyed our chat today. It's lovely talking to you. You know, and I know how successful you are with your service accommodation business. So it's a pleasure to know you. And thank you for having me on.
Thank you so much. And we'll talk soon. Bye.